I'm seldom as excited to speak to someone as I am today, not only because I've read some of the incredible, prolific work that he's done, but also because I think he's the only really, really brilliant living language model, human living language model that can actually compete with AI and is much better than AI in so many ways too. He is Douglas Murray.
That's a very tall order.
No, I think it's fair. I don't really remember where I first heard about you, but I instantly thought, God, this guy's worth listening to.
Oh, nice.
So I'm very pleased to have you here in South Africa. You're here for a few days. There are lots of things on the agenda. But I thought maybe today, because we'll be spending a lot of time together, it would be fun to actually look at your story, pay a bit of attention to the kind of person that you are. A big part of what I think most people are fascinated by is what makes a curious person, what makes somebody interested and therefore interesting. Mm. And I don't want to irritate you with personal questions because I assume that you're a bit like me and it's much more fun talking about ideas.
Yes. Yes. And I'm also British, so we're not very good at talking about ourselves.
Well, I won't ask you about your feelings, if that's any better.
I wouldn't know what to do. I'd auto-destruct.
So let's start off with just a little bit of background. I mean, how would you explain to someone who really didn't know anything about you before they'd read any of your books or heard any of your ideas, just kind of what shaped the interests that you have in the world and in literature and in all of those things?
Well, I mean, I had a pretty ordinary upbringing, a very stable upbringing. It was very helpful.
Both parents?
Yes. And was brought up an Anglican Christian, went to local state schools, and then won a set of scholarships that took me to Eton and then Oxford. And I became a writer very early. I wrote my first book when I was 18, and it came out when I was 20. So I was sort of off to the races as a writer pretty early.
Was that Bosey?
Yes. And that sort of got me going, but that was a book of literary biography. And I was already, by the time I was at university, very interested in current events, and I was interested in the world. You know, I was that unusual undergraduate of the time who read the newspapers.
When those were a thing.
Remember that, the pleasure of reading.
And you'd have to read more than 140 characters.
That's right, that's right. It was such a pleasure. You'd get your coffee in the morning and read a newspaper from cover to cover. And I was very interested in the world. And when you mention about curiosity, I suppose it's... I mean, I think writers have to be curious. I mean, you want to find out what's going on. You want to dig and get to the truth, which I think is not an abstract concept. I think it's real. I think there is such a thing as truth, and that people can recognize it when they see it. And as for sort of curiosity, I mean, it wasn't till I was quite advanced as a student that I realized that I had an instinct that not everybody had. I sort of assumed they did, which was if somebody mentioned something I didn't know about, I recognized it was on me to find out about it. If there was a historical figure or a historical era or a person or a writer or whatever, I would think, oh gosh, I don't know about that person. I must catch up.
As opposed to just tearing down their statue now.
Yeah, or just sort of thinking, oh, well, that stuff other people know. You know, it was... I never thought it was an unusual trait, but I discovered it was fairly unusual. I realized that the onus was on me to improve myself and to find out about things and to know more. And I still have that. I mean, a sort of tearing curiosity. If somebody mentions something I don't know about, what should I read about that? What's the best thing? And as I say, that's probably quite a good foundation to be a writer.
Oh, yeah.
And also a lot of people wonder if they want to be a writer or a journalist, what should they do? And I always say read. There's an alarming amount of people who try to write poetry who've never read poetry. And it's a little bit the same with some people trying to start off as writers. You need to have read, and read pretty widely, and read the best things that have been written. And then you find that it all resonates in your head, and your head becomes like a sort of, hopefully, like a sort of cathedral where you can make a noise and it echoes.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. It also makes me think that there are so many people who haven't really read a long book, let alone more than one long book.
Well, that's the same among people who would be rather surprised by it. I mean, people in positions of power and influence, and I don't just mean politicians, who I don't especially expect to be learned, but I mean among people whose trade is words.
Yeah.
These days, I mean, very many people don't actually make it through a book. I had a friend who writes on politics in Westminster who about 10 years ago said to me, I don't think I've read a book in 10 years. I've read excerpts of books, I've read serializations of books, but I don't think I've sat down and read a book. And that really saddened me, because I still regard the book as the best way to communicate between one person and another. There's no intermediary, really. Yeah. I mean, there's editors who can sometimes help, or are meant to help people formulate or refine their thoughts. There's copy editors who make sure you don't make a howling error or a spelling mistake. But, I mean, by and large, it's the best medium of communication from one person to another, apart from maybe sitting opposite each other. Almost every form of communication other than that now is ameliorated by many other people in the process. I have friends who work in film and documentary and many other things. It's pretty rare for one person's vision to be the thing that makes it all the way to the audience.
Yeah.
There's focus groups, there's testing groups, there's
AI models that generate the stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one that's come online most recently, but pretty rarely is it maybe a play can do that. But most of the time, there are gatekeepers between the first vision or the first idea and the recipient. I love the book still and believe it will always survive because it has no intermediaries.
Have you run out of space for books in your house?
That's a very difficult question. I'm not. I'm at the stage of precarious piles.
Ah, okay.
Which
I remember seeing
always threatened to fall on me and kill me.
I saw a video of Christopher Hitchens once sitting in just a den full of piles of books.
He used to have his books piled up. He actually had shelves that went that way mainly, which was odd.
You knew him.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, he had nothing in his apartment. It always looked like he'd just moved in.
Yeah.
All the paintings and artwork that he had was just sort of sitting on the floor against the wall. It was never hung up. I don't know. It was a curiosity of his. But yes, I'm nearing the stage where I have to have a one-in, one-out rule with books, which is normally what spouses force on bibliophiles. But
And because you travel so much, you write an enormous amount. You're doing, 5 columns a week or something now.
Yeah.
And I imagine you've learned to write on planes and boats.
I can write in the back of a car. I can file a column.
And does it all come easily? Or do you sometimes feel, oh, my God, I've got 4 more to do and I've only this one has been...
Well, no. If I saw it as drudgery, I wouldn't do it.
But deadlines can be.
I rather enjoy them. I enjoy the discipline of them. Yeah. I pride myself on never being late with a column. I think I've pretty much held to that. I like the discipline of writing. I like the discipline of journalism. You know, you've got to get 1,500 words in by 4 p.m.
Right.
It's great.
Right.
I'm fortunate in that it comes easy to me. It doesn't always, of course, as you know. I mean, sometimes you can have a false start several times on a column. But you learn with time how to avoid that. I mean, I've learned to be very brutal with myself as an editor. You know, if something's not working, I just scrap it all and start again. Or think, oh, no, the opening paragraph's not the thing. You need to start on... Quite a good tip usually is start with the second sentence or start with the second paragraph.
Okay.
Quite often the first... Like, this is for everyone. Students, I often find this with. Quite a lot of students, when they're writing essays for school, actually the opening is verbiage. The opening is throat clearing. You're taking time to get to your point, and you should get to it straight away.
And mechanically, is it a laptop? Is it a
laptop? And I type very fast. Sometimes people say, "How do you write so many So how do you write so much? I write fast.
Right. Not like me. I sit there and look like a chimpanzee at a typewriter.
It's a pleasure. It's a wonderful profession, a wonderful life.
Well, you're also very good at it. I always say to people that there are three concentric circles. There are the things that you love, the things that you're good at, mm-hmm. and the things that can make you money.
Right.
And for some people, that area where they have overlapping magisterium is it's the golden thread of their lives.
Although in general, I tell people if they want to make money, don't become a writer.
Well, it's probably true for most people.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes, particularly because journalism's obviously gone through a bad time in the last 20 years with everything being made free and the digitalization, the money models are all off. I think it's coming back. But yeah, and I have some journalist friends who say, you know, their children, one said to me recently, my son's written a piece and it's good. What am I going to do? I don't know. You've got to find a way to put him off.
Burn it.
But it's probably people who want to be actors and things. If you really if you really want to do it, nothing will stop you.
Sure. Well, I find it really interesting that there are people who just are able to distill ideas and make sense of them. And funnily enough, someone tweeted something this morning that I thought was quite interesting about Yuval Noah Harari and Malcolm Gladwell, who you had a very famous riposte with just the other day. And I thought you really only have to come up with a few good ideas in your life and be able to tell the story, elucidate them quite clearly, and then usually people will keep paying you to do the same thing. But that's not what you've done.
No, the two people you mention, I have a certain.
And I'm not laying traps for you. I promise.
No, it's fine. I never see a trap I don't walk into. Harari is an interesting one because he's a very good synthesizer of things, but he's done something I think which is very dangerous, which is that he's started to speak beyond his competency. And indeed, I think right beyond his competency. I thought Sapiens was one of the most brilliant works of history I'd ever read. It deserves all of the acclaim and all of the sales that it's got. But his stuff on the future and his increasing tendency to sort of sound off about human beings in a way that is profoundly banal, I think.
Very nihilistic, too.
It's rather nihilistic. He said the other day that we live in an era in which, he said it's on an American talk show, which is maybe where you shouldn't go to mine knowledge, but he said on an American talk show that we live for the first time in the first era in human history in which we don't know what to teach the children. And that because things are moving so fast with technology and blah, 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 he said this is a unique moment in human history. I thought, what a foolish thing to say. It's very straightforward what you teach the children. You teach them what you taught them before, the things that give you a grounding. I mean, if you teach a child a grounding in ethics, in rhetoric, in literacy, in numeracy, in
history,
in the greats, if you were to teach a child the Bible, Plato, and Shakespeare, I think I can say with 100% certainty, all of that will still be useful in 20 years' time. And it'll be useful in 50 years' time and 100 years' time.
And more is the pity that so many modern education systems don't give you any sight of things like Plato.
Well, because then you don't know what you're grounded in. And the problem is then you don't know the waters you're swimming in.
Well, isn't this also the definition of the difference between a conservative and a liberal in the old sense is that the conservatives treasure the past and consider things to be there for a reason, and that there wouldn't be any good reason to knock down the fence until you know why it was built.
Yes.
Whereas the modern left, more than the classical liberal, they're more intent on pulling it down and then figuring it out afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Always a catastrophic set of priorities there. It's always a sad thing when somebody says, let's just tear it down. Without any plan for the aftermath, because you can be pretty sure that if you have no plan, somebody else will. And that's the main. If the dialectic, to use an old-fashioned term, if the dialectic of politics is broadly speaking that there's a group in society that presents new ideas and new concepts, and another group that says hold it a minute, let's interrogate that idea more carefully and see if it's that's actually a very useful process. I don't believe in human improvement, but I believe that societies can be improved. And, you know, to give credit, that the left has often produced ideas that are very important and which needed some conservative analysis. But that doesn't mean that everything that the left comes up with is important. Some ideas should be jettisoned.
Sure.
Some of them should be rejected. But they need to be weighed up on merit. And I find that ongoing dialectic to be very important. And I don't resile from it at all. I like throwing myself into it.
Do you think it's really important to hear opinions that you don't agree with and to hear the best arguments from people whose viewpoint you're likely to oppose?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because that also seems to be quite an old-fashioned idea to some people.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, to use the famous explanation of John Stuart Mill on this, writing in the 19th century, you have to know other people's opinions because I mean, you could discover that you're wrong, and who wouldn't want to know if they were wrong? you might discover you're wrong in part, and again, you'd want to fix that. And the least bad thing is that you might discover the strength of your own arguments and strengthen them on the knife of their opinion. And their wrong opinion, erroneous opinion, misguided opinion. And that also is very useful. I mean, all I would say is that I have found throughout my career so far that I read a lot of work that I disagree with. Why would I not? I read papers that I don't find myself in alignment with, columns I don't agree with, and books which... often strike me as being sort of effluent, but nevertheless, I'm pleased to have read them and to have realized that. One thing I would say is I've discovered, to my sadness actually, in my career, that the favor isn't returned. There was a memorable time some years ago when my book, The Strange Death of Europe, was coming out in translations around the world, and I try to always go to a country that I haven't been to for a while if there's a translation of one of my works coming out.
Right.
I happened to go to Sweden for the Swedish launch of this book, and I had a slightly out-of-body experience as I was in the Swedish public radio station. You may have missed it. There was a discussion. There was an interview with me, which was followed by a discussion in Swedish about me with two people on either side, and I found it a rather uncomfortable experience to hear it. People saying, you know, sort of hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-hurdy, Douglas Murray. I was like, is it good? Is it bad?
Yeah, correct.
So I sort of said, can I step out for this a bit? It's a very uncomfortable position to be in. I discovered afterwards that the very brilliant young woman who was, as it were, on my side in the discussion in the studio, at some point in the discussion said to her counterpart, who was a sort of rather angry leftist malcontent in middle age, that she said, have you read Douglas's book? And he said, well, no, I know what he says. And she says, how would you know what he's saying if you haven't read his book? And that's quite common. And what you discover is, of course, is that people who do that, this isn't an insistence, everyone needs to read my books. although I do sort of think if you're going to talk about
good
them,
idea,
you should probably sell
some books, Douglas.
You should probably have a go at reading them.
Sure.
But the point about it is that, of course, it means that somebody has a completely ill-informed view of what you're saying. There were arguments I made in that book, which I think were pretty original, hadn't been said before. And people like this Swedish gentleman missed out on that. And I think that's a mistake.
Oh, but you see, he takes the risk then of actually learning something which is unwelcome news.
Yes.
And actually having to deal with you.
Well, that's a very interesting thing, because I test myself on this. We probably test each other on this as well. Are there books or ideas that you don't want to look into because you would find them very uncomfortable?
Well, for example, I really don't like watching snuff films on the
internet.
Well,
that's different. I mean,
but I think that's a moral, ethical decision that I take a priori and decide, look, I'm not going to get into this because it's going to upset my whole day. I think I know different. What's going to happen. I don't need to
watch. With 100% certainty.
Give me an example.
Well, sometimes, for instance, very devout believers in a religion, or fairly devout believers.
You're in no danger here, by the way, but yes.
Actually, people who are doubting quite often don't want to go near the literature which they think might push them over the edge into atheism, for instance.
Mm.
I understand that instinct, but I also deprecate it. I think it's a shame. I think that a lot of people have that in different ways. You know, this is an idea I don't really want to contend with because I think it might shift me. Yep. Maybe that's fine for some people. I don't think that's at all good for a writer. I can't do that myself. If there's an idea or a subject matter or something I think that is going to be unpleasant, I need to look at it, you know.
Which is why you also go to conflict zones all the time. Yes. I mean, you've said famously that you like to go to an either unpleasant or dangerous place as often as you can.
Yes.
Every year.
Yeah, that was Christopher used to do that, and I slightly picked up the habit from him that you should always go to at least one uncomfortable place a year. I've rather exceeded that number.
Yeah, he was very proud of being to all the Axis of Evil countries.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. I can't remember if
is Iran, North
yes,
Korea?
Actually, yes, Chris, yeah. I've been to North Korea. Yeah. I went to North Korea some years ago, yeah.
But where among these places, since we've stumbled onto this subject, where have you found that you're the most uncomfortable?
Well, most war zones aren't very pleasant.
No, I saw you talking to Piers Morgan the other day while there were actual bombs going off behind you.
Yeah, I mean, but funnily enough, with that, I don't... I was in Ukraine with my friend Bernard Roy Levy with the Ukrainian army when they were advancing on Kherson and taking back territory from the Russians in 2022. Yeah. And it was funny. He's covered a lot of conflicts as well. And we agreed that actually we weren't bothered by mortar fire or rockets or anything like that because it's just luck, you know. Now, sometimes you're unlucky, and I've known plenty of people who've been unlucky. But generally speaking, you just sort of think, well, I've got the same chance of being hit as anyone else here. So,
what did Churchill say about the best possible feeling in the world is?
Yes, being shot at without result. that is quite a nice feeling.
I'm sure.
But actually, being the thing that is unpleasant is if you have a sniper on you, if you are the target. I was once covering the war in northern Nigeria, which is a very unpleasant conflict, which has not had enough attention at all, and is of course ongoing, where the Fulani militia, you know, target the Christians, and it's just beyond awful, and. There'd just been a suicide bombing at the church on Easter Sunday when I was there, and the unpleasant thing about that conflict was that the militias sort of knew that we were in the area, and that's unpleasant, is if you know somebody's looking for you. My room was rather ineptly ransacked one night in my absence, and that's unpleasant, but. You know,
the ongoing and difficult thing for so many people who are involved with writing as much as you do and covering as many different things going on in the world simultaneously as you do is to decide what's actually important and what isn't.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
And I don't know whether you've got some sort of hack to decide on a daily basis, because we're now, you spoke earlier about how if you want to know something, you look it up and you find out what it is. If this person you've never heard of and it's important to you, you look for the information. And there's more information now than there's ever been. And it can be overwhelming. And for many people, it can be, it can paralyze them. They never get beyond.
Actually, that's true. Yes.
They get beyond just having constant streams of info.
Overload. You can get it. You can get that feeling very easily, as you know, if you just scroll through Twitter or Instagram for too long. More than about an hour, and you're in the hole, and then everything seems like it's going to hell, and yes. Well, one priority is, as a writer, you've got to go towards the things that are most interesting to you. Very often, it's a matter of looking at what's on your own doorstep. I've been making a documentary in the U.S. about the fentanyl crisis, which is an extraordinary epidemic in America of these terrible Chinese opioids that have found their way through Mexico into the American drug market, and they're killing. They're killing people not just who are heroin addicts who need fentanyl to get a high, but they're killing, you know, people, the families of those who are killed, which is more than 100,000 Americans. The families often reject the name overdose on their death certificates of their loved ones because it's not an overdose. It's actually a poisoning. People, for instance, who've bought a pill. There was one poor young man who bought some, sleeping pill or something on the Mexican side of the border the other week, and took it when he came back, and it was pure fentanyl, and he didn't know it. He was killed. Jesus. Now, you can't say that's an overdose in a way. You know, that is just somebody's been poisoned. I was speaking to the parents of a poor young woman who was a professional who lived in New York, and she was one of three professionals who died of fentanyl poisoning in one evening in Manhattan.
My God.
Because a dealer had deliberately laced the cocaine that he was selling with fentanyl. And I sort of sympathize with this plight. This isn't really overdosing, this is poisoning. It's a pretty extraordinary story, and I sort of knew it would be when I started looking into it and speaking to addicts and speaking to victims and the families and all this sort of thing. But the more you look at it, the more extraordinary it was. But that was something I sort of knew I had to look at, because I see it on my doorstep in America, where I spend much of my time. The streets are covered in people who are just out of it, and it's just tragic and horrible, and you think, how can this happen in a first world country?
So Oregon have just reversed their very famous decision to legalize all sorts of recreational drugs. They've decided to go back on that. I wonder if it's got anything to do with this. I mean, it's killing more people than COVID ever did.
Yes.
Right? And look at how disproportionate that response was. You would think, again, where are people putting their attention?
Yeah.
What should you look at?
Yes.
And they're more interested in, you know, this mysterious Chinese virus, which, frankly, we were all a bit worried about in the beginning.
Well, you know, actually, COVID's quite a good example of attention, because I do have a sort of rule I try to play by, which is never be the 100th, you know what, looking on a thing. Like, a lot of people are at the moment, I think, slightly wasting their time by becoming the millionth expert in that day's problem, and their opinions are not very informed or worthwhile. I ducked the COVID thing because I've never taken any interest before in pandemics, and I didn't want to be one of those people who just leaps on everything and is an expert in everything. I think sometimes you have to say, look, this is a complex one I just haven't given enough thought to, and I'm not going to get up to speed in
the magic words, I don't know.
I'm not going to get up to speed in 3 weeks. I'm not going to pretend. There are people online, of course. It's awful to keep coming back to the online world, but it so dominates our world these days. There are people who move in a matter of days from being, you know, COVID experts to fentanyl experts to Afghan withdrawal experts to Ukraine war experts to Middle East conflict experts. And I don't think it's a very good use of your time to pretend that. Some journalists pretend it, but we have a class now of people who are not journalists. That's fine, sort of citizen journalists. Hmm. But they very often spread themselves too thin, and it's much, much better to be an expert on one thing. It's like it's better to know one book really well, a really good book really well, than to have a smattering of a knowledge of a few.
You told an incredible story once. I hope it's not completely unrelated, but you spoke about a Russian woman who had worked on a translation.
Oh, yes, of Byron's Don Juan.
Of Byron. Yes. And she did an entire Russian translation from memory.
Yes.
In prison, yeah. In the gulag.
Yeah.
And she, I mean, by the end of it, that became the definitive version.
Yes.
And still is.
Yes, it's one of the great...
Remarkable.
It's one of my favorite stories. I told it in my Things Worth Remembering column last year. Tatiana Gnadich was
That's her
name. Yeah. Remarkable woman. A hero of the 20th century. One of those people who not enough people know about, but the courage, the knowledge. Yes, she was an expert in English literature. An ancestor of hers had translated Pushkin. She was purged from the university in St. Petersburg. Lived with her mother in St. Petersburg, Leningrad, as it then was, during the siege. Her mother was killed. Her house was burnt down. She ended up handing herself into the authorities because she had a desire to go to England. So she was immediately given 10 years in the gulag. And on her first night, she was in the holding prison, and the head of the prison said, there are actually some books here if you wanted to have them to read now. And she said, shut up, I'm working. And he said, what are you working on? She said, I'm translating Byron's Don Juan,
which is
a 19,000-word epic. I'm translating it into Russian in my head. And he said, well, how do you deal with it when you run out of... She said, it is difficult to hold it all. And he said, well, what if I give you a piece of paper and you write some of it down? And overnight, she wrote down the whole of the canto in which Don Juan visits Moscow. It translated from English into Russian. And he said, if I give you the paper and you stay here, can you keep doing it? And she said, yes. And she worked on it for 2 years, finished it. The prison guard got 3 copies printed and sent her off to the gulag with one of them. She spent 8 years revising it in her bunk bed, came out of the gulag and went to a house of one of her remaining friends who had 5 people living in his apartment, and asked if she could come and stay and finish her work on her translation. And it was published a few years later, and it's now the Russian translation of Byron's masterpiece.
Remarkable.
Well, what I like about it is not just her story, but the reminder that people are remarkable, or can be remarkable. And our ambitions for ourselves should be a lot higher than they are. And they can only be higher than they are if we think of remarkable people like that woman.
Who most people wouldn't know.
No.
I think it's great that you've at least dug up the story
yeah.
on her. Now, you mentioned she was an expert on English literature in this case. And I agree with you. There are lots of people who are experts on a daily basis on things that they actually don't know terribly much about. It's very surface, paper-thin stuff. But I don't think anyone would think that you're just an expert in one thing. And I've always hated that jack of all trades and master of none statement. I think it's really puerile. And I prefer a Renaissance man or polymath. And I think you're interested in lots and lots of things. Mm. And you can speak with authority on a great many things. And I've seen you do it. Mm. So this is not the entree to an argument. What it is the question around whether you could be expert, and I think you exemplify this, in a number of things.
Oh, yeah, of course you can be. It's just you can't know
everything.
It's
hard work.
I mean, you can't know everything anymore. To go back to the Harari comment, I mean, there was actually a very important moment in the early 19th century when the nature of the printing press and the availability of books escaped the opportunity of one person to know it. In the 18th century, you could be on top of pretty much all the major
sort of literary works. Turing test of the 1900s.
Yes, exactly. And then at some point, some people say maybe Coleridge was one of the last people who'd read sort of almost everything that was available. But by now, it's not possible. I mean, there are more books published every day than most people can read in a lifetime. And that's an interesting, it's an interesting change in human knowledge, because it means that to an extent we're all in different furrows. But I think you can still have a found, you can still have, and actually it's a very important thing, particularly for the creation of a young mind, is you can still have a knowledge of the foundations. If you have a knowledge of the foundations, you can be in pretty good stead. You'll never get completely lost. And if you have a knowledge of the foundations, the world will never be a total stranger to you. If you don't have good foundations, if you haven't got the education of the basics, and that can be done whatever your socioeconomic status should be able to be done
especially
wherever
now,
you are.
I mean,
especially now,
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Think of the revolution this could give in human knowledge instead of making us all stupider. We could all know a lot more, much more swiftly, and people with very little, few or no means could become much more educated immediately than somebody at an Ivy League university.
And that's absolutely taught. Objectively true in some
absolutely.
Cases. But again, how do you decide? So when you're, I know that you memorize part of what you referred to now as things worth remembering, which you do with Barry Weiss, which I think is absolutely great on her Substack. It's one of the things, the few things that I make sure I am subscribed to, because again, time is the issue, and there's some things that are worth remembering. And I think you've looked back. I think this week you spoke about C.S. Lewis, who's having a bit of a revival.
Ah, I'm pleased to hear that.
Well, I think as a Christian apologist, post the atheists of the 90s, I think C.S. Lewis has come back into fashion.
Well, he was a wonderful stylist, a wonderful, wonderful brain, wonderful range of knowledge. But yes, I mean, he was a great synthesizer of thought, and gave consolation to huge numbers of people throughout his life, and I think still today. He's very big in America, I know, still. I think perhaps more than in his native land. But as a stylist, among other things, he was superb. He had what I described as the opposite of the modern tendency, which is that an academic today, particularly in humanities, is most likely to take either a banal thought or an untrue thought and try to spin it out to make it impenetrable to the layman. C.S. Lewis had the opposite. He had the true skill, which was to take incredibly complex ideas and theology and much more and make it understandable to all. And that's a real skill. That's something we should all really admire.
I think you do that. You've done it for many people, and I know they call you a right winger and the controversial Douglas Murray. Who
people get controversial stuck in front of their name as like a warning label. There are many people who call for the most terrible violence who never have controversial put in front of their name.
Well, you've written about subjects that are. Seemingly to people who don't want to address them, perhaps those people who you said might not want to read things that they're uncomfortable about, immigration, history, gender, race. I mean, most people, when you're young and your parents want you to grow up and be well-mannered, say to you, you shouldn't talk about those things. Those are the things you should avoid at all costs at dinner parties.
They say never talk about religion or politics at dinner. Well, that reduces you to the hellish British dinner party situation of only being able to talk about the weather.
Which is what most people start with.
It's some people's idea of heaven. It's my idea
horrible.
Of hell.
Absolutely. Horrible. So it doesn't bother you. I know it doesn't. It's almost a rhetorical question. It doesn't bother you that some of your opinions get you death threats on a daily basis. There are places in the world that you probably, look, you would, because you've got a bit of a, I wouldn't say a death wish, but you're certainly not afraid.
No,
you're
I
brave as
death.
Hell. I mean, yeah, I think it was Jordan Peterson who said in an interview with you the other day that he thinks you're one of the bravest people in the world, and probably many people would agree with that. What
well,
save
I always,
you from talking about yourself?
I never like writers being described as brave, because I think
well,
I think firefighters are brave and firemen are brave and soldiers are brave, you know.
Yes, but
and they don't get patted on the back for it very much.
So. Okay, but we're in an era of ideas, and the fire in the crowded theater was a much more dangerous metaphor at a time when that was a more dangerous thing. And now I think ideas like that can have you burn in a crowded theater, and you'd be the centerpiece.
Well,
does it bother you?
I've never really, I mean, I've never really thought that anything should put me off saying what I think is true.
Okay, so you mentioned that at the beginning, and it's very hard sometimes for me to figure out what, you know, what themes drive me. But this is clearly something that is a big part of you, and I've always been fascinated by the way that you write about things, and you expose things that are not true for what they are, and you help people, like C.S. Lewis did with complex things, theology and so on, to see what is. Why does truth matter?
Well, it's the only guiding principle we should have. I mean, it's true that a lot of people try to orient their lives these days towards fabrications or, you know, things that they wish were the case. But I've just never thought that that's very healthy. I think it's much more important to look at things as they are than to invent things and pretend that that's the way. I mean, for instance, a lot of people today in the era of feelings would like to construct the world around them so that they're not hurt. I don't think this is possible, or indeed desirable. I mean, if you believe that you can get through life without having your precious feelings hurt, you're going to get an awful surprise at the end. Because there's an unavoidable thing coming down the end of the road. We as human beings have to accept certain things. We're all going to die. Everyone we love is going to die. And suffering is a perennial in life. And from a king to a, you know, the poorest person in the land, everybody has to face up to that. There's no way of avoiding it. No way of dodging it. But I think that a lot of people in our time do think they can dodge it and would like the world to adapt to them. And I think that's foolish. I think that it's also narcissistic, obviously. But part of the world is not just seeing how things could be bettered, and that's a very important thing to do, but also seeing what you should accept and making your peace with it. A very big influence on me, Roger Scruton, the conservative philosopher, who's a great friend, used to say this, that, you know, that the thing of finding ourselves, finding a way to be at peace with the world is also very important. And you can only be at any kind of peace with the world if you accept the world as it is and recognize that people are what they are, rather than pretending that they're something else, you know. So I regard truth as being important for lots of reasons, but one is simply that it saves you time.
you're making me think of Robert Kennedy's some folks see the world as it is and say why, and that's probably where you would end the sentence. Well, and he carried on and went, I see things as they are and as they could be and say why not.
Yes, it's a very important
sentiment.
Yeah. And I think both should be in constant dialogue. In fact, and I know that because they're in constant dialogue inside ourselves all the time, aren't they? I mean, these divides don't go down 50% of the population, 50%, they go down right the heart of all of us.
Sure.
The desire to improve, the desire to protect, the desire to nurture, the desire to shock people out of situation. So yes, Bobby Kennedy was a remarkable person, by the way. He's getting a little bit of a renaissance now.
With his son being as important on the American political scene as he is. So, I mean, there's so much I want to still ask you about literature, and you have famously memorized lots and lots of poems, which I think is fantastic. We always had a teacher at primary school who said, look, boys, you're all stupid. But if you learn what other people said off by heart, you say those things, people will think you're clever. So that's the next best thing.
I do it for a different reason, which is I think that you should try to furnish your head with the best thoughts. As I've mentioned before in my column on this, I think that sometimes it happens to me still, you know, I'll read something and I'll think, oh, I need that. I need to put this up here. And it's a wonderful thing. It's harder with age, of course. When you're young, your brain is so malleable. That's why people can very often remember poems or chants of how to remember certain things that they were taught in school 60 years earlier. The memory is much more absorbing when you're young, obviously. So it's a little harder now, but I still will come across a passage sometimes and I'll think, okay, I know it requires a little bit more work than it used to, Douglas, but put it up there. And yeah.
The other thing is the idea that when I read some of your stuff here about race and gender and sexuality and culture in War of the West, which I thought was fascinating, a lot of what I see in the behavior of people who are identity obsessed almost seems to be that the identity categories to which they choose to subscribe or by which they would prefer to be identified, if you're being more charitable, those are almost placeholders for what would have been, and this is a
faith,
bit mean,
religion,
or character and personality.
Character, personality, yes, absolutely.
That if you just read a few books or learnt a funny story or...
You don't need to invent a new gender to just be who you are. I mean, you don't need to pretend that you've always existed in this time. You're just, you know, there are people. I don't know why our age finds this so difficult. You know, I mean, okay, some people are flamboyant, some people are not, some people are attracted to lots of people, some are not. I mean, so what? None of this is very interesting. It's certainly not interesting enough to spend any time tearing ourselves apart about it. I find that the whole gender thing is just a bollard thrown into the middle of the road to make us all go mad and spend our lives driving into it. I'm not interested in driving into it anymore. I said everything I had to say about gender in The Madness of Crowds some years ago, and if I say so myself, everything I say has been proved correct. We keep discovering medical scandals that I predicted would be coming out, which are coming out. And I think that whole thing is very sad, and it's just not what I think people should spend their time obsessing over. I suppose they can if they want. I don't want them to waste my time with any more of this.
But it is funny that the majority opinion, which I think is closer to what you've expressed in Madness of Crowds, that most people see this stuff as fairly self-evident, and that it doesn't, and it has been for thousands and thousands of years of human evolution, and now we're required to suspend our disbelief as if you're going into a fantasy movie and do this in order to accommodate people who... And what bothers me about that, it takes people like you and J.K. Rowling, who's just become a bit of a hero to many people,
she's
and
great.
Obviously a terrible enemy to so many others.
She's been great.
Standing up for good old feminism in its first incarnation,
It's not just good old feminism.
Reason.
It's just fact. It's just fact. Like, don't waste my time with this stuff. You know, come on. We have to pretend there's that people don't have a sex and that they're just assigned a sex at birth by a bigoted nurse who's just guessing.
Yeah.
Come on.
Foisting some identity on you.
Come on. It's such palpable nonsense, and we all know it. And we don't have to be mean to anyone. We shouldn't be mean to anyone. But I'm not going to be persuaded to lie. And, you know, I said this a few years ago on Joe Rogan's podcast. But the reason I object to that is that I don't have anything against any group of people. I know what happens if you're made to lie.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that if you're made to lie once, you'll be made to lie again and again and again until you live in a universe of untruth.
Isn't that what George Orwell...
It's what George Orwell, among others, warned against. warned about. It's
well, it demoralizes.
It demoralizes. Well, that's the other thing. That's one of the points of it, in my view, is to demoralize people, is to make people
question everything. Everything is untrue. Everything's shades of grey.
In a way, it's question everything. In the other way, it's question nothing. Just accept what you're told and agree with it. It was very funny. I mentioned in the War on the West, there's something that's developed in America called equitable maths.
Oh, yeah?
Which is the idea that mathematics is a Western colonial white man thing. And as I say, with a... First of all, this nonsense, the history of mathematics comes up through ancient Mesopotamia, from ancient Babylon, a whole range of cultures. and it's used across the world, not because white men were involved, but because it works. It works.
And contributions like the zero that the Arabian culture contributed to.
Right.
These were not all
Never
Western.
Say, by the way, no. that Arabian culture... produced zero. Watch out.
Well, okay, let's just say the numeral. I don't want to get into the trouble you do. I have a feeling, though, over the course of the next few hours, we will encounter much trouble. It would be remiss of me to not
I wanted to mention the equitable math, but point out that the reason why it's very strange, people in America, as I say, this is a movement that is growing. People should think that this isn't some crazy idea, but it is a crazy idea, but it's not an idea of my own invention, as it were. One of the things that they tried to come up with was that 2 + 2 = 4 is a racist construct. And they said there are other ways of knowing, which is not true. 2 + 2 = 4, not because it's somebody's view, but because it's correct. Try to build a bridge based on the foundation idea that 2 + 2 can be anything. But it was very funny because when this happened, there was a sort of storm about it online. Somebody pointed out to one of the people pushing this that actually in George Orwell's 1984, there is a passage where the party demands that people say 2 + 2 = 5. Mm-hmm. And somebody pointed this out to one of the originators of the recent attempt to push this, and he said that was indeed unfortunate.
Well,
I
wonder sometimes what Orwell would have thought about what's going on now, because it's almost as if he was prescient.
Oh, he was very prescient, of course.
Orwell's
also being duffed up now. So a new book about him says that he wasn't all that nice in his private life.
That's always what they do.
Oh,
I must congratulate you on something else, because you've been doing a series on YouTube debunking...
Uncancelled history.
Right, debunking all of the nonsense that people are now saying in character assassination of great people, people who've really helped to make the world...
for
all of us. I think it's terrific.
It's a lot easier to tear down than to build up, and it's much easier to look back at remarkable men and women of the past and say, why weren't they exactly like me, than it is to say, I wonder what they have to teach me, and maybe I have something to learn.
Before we finish, because I do want to get to this, you just talked about the equitable maths, and South Africa was the cradle of... decolonization, the decolonization movement, UCT famously with Roads Must Fall, decolonize education. It's still something that people who should know better are proffering as an alternative way of learning about the world and what's important in it. Do you have any comments on that? Because you've been quite unequivocal about how you think that this nonsense of reparations and the idea that there is guilt forevermore about slavery, but only for European countries and for America. Do you feel that the same argument can apply to education and this decolonized movement?
Well, I simply think that it should be challenged. It may have something to add, but it should be challenged. It shouldn't be able to just run rampant and... for people to be expected to just accept it or believe it. I mean, I'm all for revising our attitudes towards the past. I think that happens all the time. That's a historical dialogue. Mm. Everything looks in a different light depending on where you're looking at it from.
And there's new information.
And there's new information, sure. new ways of seeing things. But that has to be done in context. And what I think is happening with the decolonization movement is that it's just applying a one-size-fits-all interpretation of everything onto everything. Colonization is a part of history, including, of course, in this part of the world.
Yeah.
But it's not the only part of the history.
No.
And to pretend it is, it's like to pretend that the history of... I mean, to pretend the history of America is entirely about slavery is like pretending the history of Africa is entirely about slavery. No, there's lots of history. And you'd want to know as much of it as you could. So I think that these are simplistic ways in which in which people force generally their political views on people and try to shut people up by saying there's only one interpretation, and it's my interpretation. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, I think that it's a great mistake to believe that we stand as judge, juror, and executioner on the past. Because the past often has a lot to tell us. I have an editor, one of the journals I write for, who has a very good rule of thumb. He says, since every era does things that we look back at and we think, that was insane. Yes, it's worth looking at those eras and thinking what it was they did, but it's also worth recognizing that just as everyone before us did mad things that they didn't question, except that we will be doing mad things at the moment as well. And maybe a good use of your time is to work out what terrible things we're doing now and stop them. I mean, for instance, I give this example on slavery, but there are more slaves in the world today than there were at the height of the transatlantic slave trade. This is not... We can do both these things. We can recognize the evils of the transatlantic slave trade and also commit to trying to stop slavery today. This isn't a zero-sum game. It's not an either-or game.
Right.
But what is better among those things? To deal with a problem that's going on today, or to try to retrospectively deal with a problem that no one alive had anything to do with, and no one alive directly suffered from.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one other point I make about that, if I can, which is, it's also about the formation of souls, the formation of character. What you teach young people is... going to be a huge amount of what they become as adults. And if you teach people to look at all of history as being against them, to say that the world is currently set up against them and that's the only thing that's happening and so on, you will breed people of resentment, which is something I go into in The War on the West. I use Nietzsche carefully, as you have to, rather it's quite hot stuff, as he himself said, he's dynamite. But using Nietzsche carefully, there's a very important passage in his work, in The Genealogy of Morals, about the person of resentment. The person of resentment leads a terrible life. To be resentful is to lead a terrible life. The only thing that can counter it is an attitude of gratitude. That is not just what have I not got, but what have I got? And that is an attitudinal shift that can be made, but it can certainly be taught. And I say this because my observation, you can meet, the reason why the resentment-gratitude thing goes so deep, and like everything else, they say goes down the center of all of us, we could all become people of resentment. Like we can all become bitter, jealous. But the reason I know that this is a human truth is that we probably both met people who seem to have an awful lot in worldly terms who are very resentful people. Mull on the things they haven't got or what that person did to them or their sister cheated them out of this or whatever. And they will lead a very unhappy life. At the same time, I suspect that you, like me, have met people who seem to have almost nothing in worldly terms and who live lives of gratitude, kindness, generosity. Now how? They've mastered themselves and they've mastered a key to the world. So it's clearly possible to go either of these ways, but to breed a generation, to educate a generation into resentment, particularly if you live in comparatively good times, it seems to me to be a great mistake, because you'll create people who want to tear down rather than build. And I don't think we should be tearing apart history. I think we should be looking at history. And more importantly, I think we should be making history.
I can't think of a better way to end that. Thank you.
Great pleasure.
Bloody fantastic.